Welcome to Health Hats, learning on the journey towards best health. I'm Danny Van Leeuwen, a two-legged, cisgender, old white man of privilege living in a food oasis who can afford many hats and knows a little bit about a lot of healthcare and a lot about very little. Most people wear hats one at a time, but I wear them all at once. We will listen and learn about what it takes to adjust to life's realities in the awesome circus of healthcare. Let's make some sense of all of this. I attended yet another session with healthcare experts where I heard clinicians and academics saying, "We're all patients." If I spoke to them as Patient Smith rather than Dr. Smith, would they embrace their inner patient? I don't know. I didn't test it. Lived experience takes many forms: advocacy, coaching, expert panels, advisory panels, informing research, and more. Many patient experts and advisors struggle with the tension of receiving payment for their lived experience. What's the value if their expertise is success living with a medical condition? What if they were business, marketing, advocacy, policy consultants without lived experience? What would they be paid? What's the value of this combined expertise in the market? Wesley Michael, a marketing entrepreneur, founded a company, Rare Patient Voice, to offer companies and researchers panels of rank-and-file people with lived medical experience to inform product marketing and participate in qualitative research. Rare Patient Voice pays patient participants a flat hourly rate. Before we listen in on my conversation with Wes, I'd like to respond to those of you that have asked about the music on my podcast. My cousin Joey Van Leeuwen provides me with all the music I use, including the backing you hear now. Joey is a brilliant, talented New Orleans, Boston percussionist, composer, and arranger. Stay to the end of the episode to hear one of the tracks of his that I use. I will share other tracks in subsequent episodes. Thanks for asking. And now for the chat with Wes. Good morning, Wes. Thanks for joining me.
It's great to be with you, Danny. This is exciting.
Yeah. How do you introduce yourself in a social situation?
Well, it's funny. It's social. I have a new 6-month-old grandchild. So usually it's all about that. It's like I'm the grandfather of Taylor. Yeah. Otherwise, I was the father of – never about me, okay. But it's very, very exciting.
Yeah, and you'll see on my business card, one of my credentials is OPA. Which is grandpa in German and Dutch.
Oh, I was wondering what that, I thought it was some sophisticated educational thing.
It's not like, at all.
Well, it's like in your introduction, you talk about cisgender. To be honest, I had to look that up. I'm like, I don't want to, I don't want to say anything. It's like, oh, well, I'm cisgender too.
Right. It just means I'm straight. And I do that because I'm interested in health equity. Uh-huh, and I think it's important for me to lay out up front that I'm a two-legged cisgender old white man of privilege. So people know where I'm coming from.
Yeah, no, okay. I think that's fair.
If you're in a professional situation, then how do you introduce yourself, as grandpa?
Yeah, exactly. Well, sometimes that may happen. But typically it revolves around the business, which is Rare Patient Voice. So I'm the president and I founder of Rare Patient Voice, which we're a market research firm which works with patients and caregivers and gives them the opportunity to take part in surveys and interviews and things like that. So usually it's from that perspective.
And what's your professional background?
So I've been in market research for many years. I used to work in the consumer area for General Mills, you know, Wheaties and Total and Betty Crocker, those products. And then I also worked for McCormick, the spice company, in marketing and market research. And then 20-some years ago, I got involved in the healthcare arena. And it's been fascinating because, you know, a lot of these companies will try to apply some of that learning, but obviously it's similar, but it's very different as well. So I've been in that working for different companies, but in the market research vein, in other words, what are people thinking and why?
How did you make that leap from Wheaties to healthcare?
Well, you know, it's funny. It was the timing was very good. In the 90s is when the direct-to-consumer ads, all those ads we see on TV with the horrible side effects and ask your doctor, that's when they became legal. So all these pharma companies, they, you know, who could be more expert in talking one-on-one with a physician and trying to push their pills, if you will. But they knew nothing about people, consumers, patients. And so they said, we need to learn about this. So that was a natural leap for me. It says, oh, that was my area. And it was so interesting to talk to these companies that were so smart about one area, but so ignorant about the other area. And then over time, not only have they gotten better, but thank God people have realized it's not just about the doctor prescribing something. It's about the patient. They're smart. They look things up. They have alternatives. People realize they have to bring them into the party. Took a while, though.
So did you go from Wheaties to healthcare and to founding Rare Patient Voices, or was there an intermediate step?
Yeah, so I worked for 20 years or so working for healthcare market research firms.
Oh, okay.
And the funny thing is, one of the first clients we had was in the hemophilia space. And hemophilia, there's a very, very small number of people with it, but we were asked by a company, hey, this is very important to us, but we really don't know much about the patients at all. Can you develop a hemophilia patient panel and caregiver panel? And then we can from time to time do interviews and surveys and learn about them. So we said, and we went to the National Hemophilia Foundation and set up our table, and we had giveaway items because mostly young boys in that case, because the whole generation had been wiped out with AIDS and you know, when, before they knew what was going on in the blood supply. And so we had, I remember I said, I know a little boys one. We'll do little airplanes and silly putty. We had various things. So we signed folks up. It wasn't even on the internet. It was paper and pencil. And it worked out really well. We got people that were really interested, sharing their voice. And then from time to time, we'd do surveys and interviews. And then a few years after that, somebody came up to me and said, I hear you have this wonderful hemophilia panel. Can we access? I said, well, no, because it's proprietary. It was developed for a client. But it got me thinking, I wonder if there's a business in this. And I kept telling my wife, someday I'm going to do this. And over the years, I kept seeing the growth in people interested in patients and the difficulty it was in finding them for surveys and stuff. And then everything came together for me. It was now 6 years ago when the company I was with was having some troubles. And the timing was perfect. My wife had been out of the workforce for 10 years raising our kids. And she had just gotten a job, and she had her healthcare, right? It's all about healthcare. And I said, look, I'm going to do this now. And it was perfect timing. And what was the first thing I did? I went back to the hemophilia conference because I've been working in that category for years. I knew there was a demand, and I knew it worked because I had done it before. Now we've got 400 and some diseases and 100,000 people. And last year we did 1,000 studies. So it's, I knew there was something there. I didn't know how much. I thought, oh, from time to time, maybe you'll do a hemophilia study. Well, no, now we'll do studies in every category up to 100 a month or more.
Are most of your clients pharma and academia?
Yeah, that's a good question. Indirectly, it's pharma. Directly, it's other market research companies.
Oh.
Or, and it's because they're working in turn for pharma, they're working for device companies, wheelchair studies, for example, that kind of thing. Academics, definitely. One thing we like to do is we'll get requests from students, like PhD students, and for part of their thesis, they need to do a survey. We'll be able to work pro bono for them, and they're so excited. And the difference is, if you're Merck or Pfizer, what the surveys are top secret. Right? Nobody sees. That's their marketing advantage. But when you're a student, they want to publish it anyway. So we'll say, look, you may not be able to offer a reward to people, but you can offer a summary of the results. And so many people are so excited to do that. So we're happy to do that. But most of the studies are for other research firms. They write the survey. They're all set to do the interviews, and they've worked with their client, and they go, "Oh my God, how are we going to find these people?" Mm-hmm. And then they come to us, and we do that one piece of it. We'll say we're like the middleman or the matchmaker. You know, we'll say, "Oh, you're doing a study in this disease area. We have folks that are interested to do a study," and then we pull them together.
So how do you differ from WeGo and Savvy or other lived experience brokers? I don't know if that's a term, but I made it up.
Yeah, I like that. So those are we love them, work with those companies as well as others. WeGo, I think the big difference there, WeGo, what they're best known for is the patient advocates, the leaders in the area. They find those folks and have those, and they invite them to the party. Whereas what we may have some of those, but we're not intentionally going after the leaders. Mm-hmm. We're going after the rank and file. We'll go to the events and find folks, and people will refer others. And typically our clients are looking for what's the run of the mill, the day-to-day patient or their family member thinking. So we complement each other. Sometimes we'll get a request for that, and we'll say, "Oh, that's a WeGo request."
Okay.
Now, with Savvy's interesting. They're somewhat similar, but we both have different approaches. Our approach is we go out to the patient events to find folks, mm-hmm. and it's been really successful because, hey, how do you find people? Well, they come to these events, and then those folks refer others because not everybody is involved enough to come to the events. And then what Savvy has done is they're letting people, in effect, buy into, own a part of that, and which is, I think it's a terrific approach. But ours is different. I say, hey, look, I've already put my own money into this. I'm not asking for your money. and so we reward it. So we're similar, but we take a different approach.
One of the things I noticed, you know, I signed up when we built this bridge. I went and signed up, and with your panel. And one of the things I noticed, which is something that I notice with WeGo too, is it's heavily diagnosis based, as opposed to, like you just mentioned, mobility focused or cognitive or function focused.
Right.
So it's, and I didn't see in your sign up stuff where you would be collecting or paying that is across diagnoses.
Yeah, that's an interesting question and aspect. The reason that we focus on that is a huge majority of the requests we get are built around a diagnosis. And if you think about it from farmer's viewpoint, they're working on a new treatment for a certain thing. They want people diagnosed with that. It's if they were doing a clinical trial, we need people for that diagnosed with that.
When I looked at your website, one of the things that I looked for was something about health equity. And although doing research on you guys, I felt like a strong health equity bent. I don't see something about that on your website. And I wonder, how do you manage this idea of broad representation?
I wish there was more that we could do because we're kind of in this position where we're making folks available. I think the role that we play there is simply bringing people to the party to tell their story. Mm-hmm. I think back, this dates me a bit, but I think back with when Reagan was president, you know, he was often cutting programs and people would get upset, but then he would meet an individual with a problem and how do we help this person? I want to, you know, it was all about the individual. How could you do it? But when you're talking in generalities, it's easy to say, let's cut some programs. So, well, when we have people come and do an interview or do a web thing, and if that gets to the right people, that has an effect. That can have an effect on some executive in some pharmaceutical company. Mm-hmm. How do we make this available? Listen to this person. They need to get it, and their insurance won't cover it, whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. But it's not. It's an indirect effect. I can't say, I wish we could do more. But it's like, I think by having their stories get there and by having it get to these corporations, It may have that same effect.
If we're thinking about even the very simple male versus female, rural versus urban, indigenous versus immigrant versus whatever. So You know, I know that in the work that I do, for example, with PCORI, in terms of thinking about the research and the equity of having broad representation at the table, and the challenge of research being often done with the populations that are readily available.
Yeah.
So can you speak a little bit more about that?
Sure.
Your company's in?
Yeah, it all starts with us going to the various events around the country. When I started, I was flying around to different. I would go to the MS Walk in Albuquerque, for example. And, and that's great, but I'm like, well, I can't go everywhere. I can't be everywhere. Right. And so over time, we developed a team. We call them our patient advocate team.
Okay.
And they'll go to events in their own area, pay them. They're part-time employees. Mm-hmm. And we're able to we covered like 350 events last year. So we're able to go to these all over the country. And some, as you can imagine, are much more, you'll reach much more different demographics. We'll go to Houston. And we're not set up, unfortunately, someday we'll get there. We're not set up to do like recruit in Spanish, for example. Mm-hmm. But we're happy to get people that are bilingual. We'll often say, you know, they sign up in English, but we know they know Spanish. But we'll see. I'll see. Hey, when we were at the such and such event in Houston, we got a lot of Hispanics. And we'll do a lot of work with, for example, sickle cell or HIV, things like that, where we get a broader representation. Then we ask the patients themselves, do you know anybody else? Because we give people a reward if they refer others. Okay. We don't ask them to give anybody's name, because we say, go to that person and tell them, and then they can come to us. And so that really helps spread the word. And we'll go to different groups or support groups. And it really is blanketed out. We've never done an event in Montana, but we have plenty of patients in Montana because somebody knew somebody who knew somebody.
Yeah.
We have a person who's really good with social media. And you don't just post on somebody's site. Right. And that's a good way to get in trouble. But she'll call them and talk to them and explain. And then they'll post on our behalf. And then all of a sudden, we'll reach out to all these people that we wouldn't have otherwise met.
Now a word about our sponsor, Abridge. Use Abridge as you learn if you're a zebra or a horse. Push the big pink button and record the conversation with your doctor or therapist. Read the transcript or listen to clips when you get home. Check out the app on abridge.com. ABRIDGE.com. Or download it on the Apple App Store or Google Play Store. Record your healthcare conversations. Let me know how it went. If you could wave a magic wand and change something or a couple things in healthcare today from the perch you're at, what would you want to see different?
Well, you know, there's two things that come to my mind, and they both start with an A. Access and awareness. I mean, these are things we hear over and over again. Access, obviously, people can't get the treatment they need. Mm-hmm. There's various programs and things like that, but the more we can get people, it's bad enough when there's no treatment at all and they're working on something, but when there is one and somebody can't use it, that's crazy. But awareness fits into that. What we find, you know, when I said people that had a long time being diagnosed, some of that's lack of awareness. On the physician's point of view, they're not trained in a rare disease. They're trained, I don't know if you heard the zebra theory or the zebra thing where physicians are taught, if you heard hoofbeats behind you, don't assume it's a zebra, assume it's a horse. And in other words, you know, assume the more common, which is logical, makes sense. But there are zebras, right? There are rare diseases. And sometimes nobody ever put two and two together and got to that. So raising the awareness, one from the physician side in terms of their education side, but also from the patient side, we did a lot of work with advocacy groups, and so many of our patients come through advocacy groups. And what we found, one of the key issues is a lot of them are not aware of their advocacy groups. If you work for it, you just assume people know, but they don't know. My brother-in-law had some serious kidney issues, and my wife was working for the National Kidney Foundation. He didn't know that they had things that could help him. Yeah. So it's like awareness of what's available.
Right, you know? In front.
Yeah, and the same with some of these treatments or payment, back to the access issues. One of the guys on our team, Kirk, He also has MS, and he's always advising folks, there's ways you can get a wheelchair, or you work with this group. They have, you know, he's a master of finding things mm-hmm. that are available, but it's all about having the awareness that somebody out there might mm-hmm. be able to help you. Don't sit and suffer in silence.
Yeah.
So that's my two magic wands.
What are you most proud of in your work?
Well, you know, the one thing we sign every email with, everybody on our team, we put it in our signature, and it changes. Every year we change it 3 or 4 times. We say we've rewarded patients with $4.1 million for taking part in surveys. So, and most of them tell us it's not about the money. You know, that's nice. They love the fact that people talk, but it's a nice measurable thing. We can say, and people will tell us, because, you know, they'll get $100 here or there, but they'll say, oh my God, that helped me through a tough time, or it helped me, you know, do some things, or I'm on disability, or that kind of thing. So, in a way, we're Robin Hood. We're taking from the rich and giving to the poor. But it's a win-win for everybody.
It's respectful.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that I find in my work is it's really hard to get people to include that paying people for their expertise, whether that's lived expertise to have it get in their budget upstream, because they'll say, oh, we don't have money for that. Well, really what they weren't, it's probably awareness that it's something that could have been in their budget, because they certainly budgeted for the principal investigator. You know, they didn't forget that. Okay.
But, you know, speaking of that, I also like to say there's a benefit, because in our work, we tell patients they'll get paid at the rate of $100 an hour. So if it's an mm-hmm. hour phone interview, that's $100. I think there's a benefit for the client, the sponsor, because you don't respect stuff that you don't pay for. They're like, we pay these. Let's listen to what they have to say. So I think it you're right about that. It's like they'll respect it more because they're paying the physician $300. So mm-hmm. obviously they're respecting. But it's like respect these patients' time and their insight. And I think that actually helps them do that, because they had put a dollar value on it. Or mm-hmm. we put a dollar value on it and they paid it.
You had said earlier that what you're looking for is the person on the street. When you were comparing yourself to WeGo, that you weren't necessarily looking for the advocate, the person who's, you know, done a lot of research themselves. Yeah. You're interested in the lived experience. How does what you do help the average person directly? Is there part of your program that's building skills for your panels, or are you trying to stay out of it?
What we do is we really just do the one thing, and we try to focus on that. Some sites are terrific with a lot of content and help. We haven't done that. Some places have people writing content and doing all. We do have, a Facebook page where we'll share things, and I love to share articles that I find, but mm-hmm. and that kind of a thing. Or mm-hmm. you know, you hear a radio program or TV, and we'll put it on there. But for the most part, we're offering just the one thing: the opportunity for people mm-hmm. to voice their opinions and kind of talk truth to power, right? Get it to the folks that are coming up with treatments that need to hear from the people that really were going to be using it or taking it. Okay. And I don't want to overclaim everything we do. I think people love it. We get so many people thanking us, patients were like, I really feel like I'm helping those coming after. And sometimes I feel like we're not usually involved in life-saving clinical trials. This is usually just people's opinions, but still they feel that way. And every little bit helps, you know, it helps these companies have to find out, or they're going to make decisions that are totally wrong.
When you look a year ahead for your company, where are you seeking to get to next?
We're always looking to grow what we have, more mm-hmm. folks with in more disease areas, and we're always finding more and more clients, because the more requests we have, the more we can put out. We have 400 and some clients. So we're always doing that. But in addition to that, we're looking at new areas. We're just starting to get more involved in clinical trials, because that's not an area of expertise, but it's like we have patients. We certainly wouldn't tell somebody to do them, but we could bring it to their attention, ask them to talk to their doctor. Right now, we're really just in the U.S. and in Canada, and people keep asking us, Europe especially, as the first step.
Is there anything you'd like to ask me?
I was just curious, is in all your talks with folks across all the healthcare areas, what you're, if you're hearing anything about people wanting to get more involved in sharing, getting their voice or doing research, that kind of a thing, or is that kind of below the radar?
No. I think people are really interested in sharing information. And so that works both ways. People are really wanting to get their own health data more. They're wanting to contribute their health information into the medical record, but they're also interested in having their experience have value.
Yeah.
So I think that all of that is really quite top of mind. So having said that, I would say that patients and caregivers that are dealing with acute stuff, they're buried.
You know,
they're trying to manage themselves, their families, their jobs, and no. But once things start to stabilize, they're looking to contribute. That whatever tragedy or challenge that they're having, how can this be of benefit? So I think it's that once they start to regularize their dilemma. I don't know if I'm saying it well, but you know, when you're in the middle of it, man, it's all you can deal with.
Exactly. You're fighting a fire. Yeah.
I mean, the only time I've ever seen, especially caregivers, I've started to see that people are paying for respite care for caregivers so that they can, for the caree.
Right.
Caregivers can participate, whether it's for an hour or a half a day or a day.
Right.
And so I'm seeing some movement towards thinking about that, which is, I feel like, okay, now somebody's getting it.
Yeah, exactly. Because the poor caregivers, oh my God.
Yeah. And there's so much, I mean, and they know, sometimes they know more than the person who's got the diagnosis.
Right.
Because they're dealing with the whole like constellation.
You know,
the transportation, the finances, the support systems. Well, Wes, thank you very much. If there's anything I can do for you, let me know.
Well, you've already provided me with this wonderful headset.
Good.
Every day I'll be thinking of you. Isn't that good?
Oh, well, that's very nice. Good.
But you know, thank you so much. I appreciate it. And then I'm glad that you've signed up. So give any feedback that you have or you get, please give. We always ask guests through each survey, we give people the opportunity to say, hey, click on this little thing and tell us what you think. And we get good ideas. We say, ooh, they may bring up a good point. How can we fix that? So,
yeah. Well, good. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Danny.
Have a good day.
Yeah, you too. I'll see you.
Okay, bye. I mostly work in the bubble of health advocacy, policy, measurement, research, products, software, academia, and of course, communication. Hence, Health Hats, the podcast. I am a member of WeGo Health and Rare Patient Voice and an owner of Savvy Co-op. I've had brief gigs with each. They're different, and I'm grateful for the variation and the opportunities. I consider them gateways into paid work for lived experience. Next week, we'll hear from Keith Scott, Vice President of Peer Support at Advocus Inc., who taught me much about another lived experience universe. Thanks for joining me today. Stay to hear some music from Joey Van Leeuwen. Thank you. see the show notes, previous podcasts, and other resources on my website, health-hats.com/pod. Please subscribe or contribute. If you like it, share it. Thanks. See you around the block.